a good student politician. I would like to recognize in the room the Honourable Member of Parliament, Mr. Pablo Rodriguez. Mr. Francis Caparegia. Mr. Justin Trudeau. Mr. Marc Garneau. Massimo Iacono. Thank you. Thank you. Marjali, thank you. Monsieur Bernard Patry. Half of the parliament here, huh? Thank you very much for coming, huh? So... So Mr. Ignatieff is here today because he honored us by accepting our invitation to be part of the CSU speaker series. He is on a cross-Canada tour. Donc il entreprend en fait une tournée nationale à travers les différents campus étudiants. Et nous sommes très très heureux aujourd'hui à Concordia de vous recevoir. C'est un grand privilège, merci encore. I would like to take this opportunity to thank every single member of my co-executives for the hard work they put through, every single member of the CSU staff and volunteers for making this event a success. Please a round of applause for them. I would like to thank Liberal Concordia for associating their name to this great event. Thank you again for that. Now, please allow me to read a brief passage of Mr. Ignatieff's biography, since it is very rich and I haven't had time, I have to admit, to know it by heart for today. So I'm going to read a few lines of what Mr. Ignatieff has done. During the 1968 election, the summer before his last year at university in Toronto, he flew with Pierre Trudeau's campaign plane as a national youth organizer. His first job, when he was still in university, was a writer for the Globe and Mail in Toronto. He's also worked as a reporter in Rwanda, Burundi, Angola, former Yugoslavia, and even Afghanistan. After he graduated from U of T, he got his PhD degree at Harvard and a teaching job in UBC. Since then, he taught in many universities around the world and hosted TV shows on the CBC, TVO, and BBC. In 2001, former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien appointed him as one of Canada's representatives on the International Commission on Integration and State Sovereignty, whose report, which many of my colleagues, political scientists here, student political scientists at Concordia would know, R2P, the responsibility to protect. Mr. Habib is teaching this class here present, and we all know about that. So he's written 17 books and received 11 honorary degrees, a Gemini Award, and the Governor General's Award for Nonfiction. And today, ladies and gentlemen, he's all yours.
He's all yours sounds vaguely ominous. It's very, very good of you to come out in such numbers. Merci d'être venu si nombreux cet après-midi. C'est touchant, c'est un signe de dévouement à la chose publique. I don't assume that every single person in this room is a liberal. I hope some of you are, for heaven's sake. But I do hope that all of you are here because you care about your country and you care about its politics. One of the reasons, the basic reasons I'm doing this cross-country tour is to talk about politics. I think there's a tremendous amount of disillusion with politics, and that bothers me because I'm proud to be a politician. I'm proud to put my name forward, take the risks involved. And I think my colleagues here are proud to be politicians, proud of what we do. But we face daily cynicism and detachment about politics. And we have to take our responsibility for that, and you have to take responsibility for that. When I say you have to take responsibility for it, one of the facts that I think we all need to think about is that in the October 2008 election, of the 18-year-olds who became eligible to vote for the first time, only 1 in 5 bothered to turn out. Now that's not good. When I was 21, the percentage of Canadians who voted in a federal election was about 80%. In the October 2008 election, that percentage had dropped below 60. It was in 54, 56%, somewhere in there. One of the things we need to understand about that is that that serves some people's interests just fine. A demotivated, disillusioned public who don't want to take part in the political process serves the interests of those parties that can get their base out. They don't want you to vote. Some of my political adversaries are just only too happy if you stay at home. Il faut pas tomber dans le piège. If you stay home, then you don't get the candidate you want. It's that simple. But they do. Because if they get their vote out, they get to drive the bus. And I'm here because I want you to drive the bus. I don't know where you're going to take us, but I do want you to drive the bus. So that's why I've decided to do this cross-country tour. Yesterday I was in Halifax. Tomorrow I'll be where? I'll be in Toronto, I think.
Mississauga.
Hamilton. Winnipeg. Calgary. Vancouver. Victoria. And I've, because what I want to do is engage you in discussion. I don't want to talk very long. But it's your responsibility because it's your country. But it's my responsibility as a political leader to make sure you got something worth voting for. No reason to turn out unless you've got some image, some vision of the country that attracts you, inspires you, makes you think this is worth fighting for. So that's my responsibility. So let me give you my sense very, very briefly of the challenges that you face and that we face. First, the first challenge is this. We're not just in a recession. I think you're all aware that something much more serious is going on. This kind of global restructuring of the economy. Some of the jobs we've lost during this recession are not coming back. The economy's changing. We're going into a new world. You are going to graduate in a very, very different world than was in place in 2007, 2008. In the world that you're going into, carbon will have a price. We can't keep using our atmosphere as a garbage dump. So carbon will have a price, and it'll drive innovation, forces to become more energy efficient. Second fact is that energy prices will stay high, which will put another driver in green innovation. We've got to innovate. We've got to become more efficient in energy use. Third factor that's going to be key here, and you probably don't think about this very much, but it's very important, the Canadian dollar will be at par. We built manufacturing sector in this country on a 70-cent dollar. Bye-bye. It's gone. We're in a much more competitive situation now. And the future of manufacturing in Montreal and in Ontario is changed by the fact that the dollar will be at par. There's some other factors we need to remember, too, which is we build our prosperity as a country by living next door to the United States. The markets of the future, not necessarily the United States at all. China, India, Brazil, and we haven't got market share there. We don't know how to do business there yet. I look around this room, I see people who obviously know the languages of China, the languages of India. We've got to turn the people loose in this country who know these cultures and know these places by heart. This is our atout principal, but we're not there yet. We've got market share in the United States, but we don't have market share in the markets where there's going to be growth in the future. These are some of the things that are changing your world, but there are two more that are very important, then I'll stop. One of them is, and we're all becoming aware of this, The future of prosperity in this country depends on intellectual property, not on natural resources. The resource that matters for the future of our country is in this room, and it's between your ears. That's why post-secondary education is so important. That's why long-term investment in post-secondary education research is just crucial to the future of the country. We've got to give you the best education Canada and Quebec knows how to give. And if we don't, we're going to lose the race. Because we can't depend for the future prosperity that will sustain us all just on natural resource rents. And we can't be hewers of wood and drawers of water. It's going to be intellectual property, IP, that'll be the key. And if Canada doesn't have its own IP, we got a problem. And so it's up to you. Somewhere in this room, there may be some person, and you'll think he's a little crazy, she's a little crazy, who's got an idea. That's where the future prosperity of this country is coming from. So the crazier idea, the better, in my view. Final fact, and then I'm going to sit down and take questions, is that we've got an aging population. One of the challenges that you're going to face as a generation is that the baby boomers are going to retire in the next 5 to 6 years, and then you guys have to carry the freight. You have to drive the bus. You will be a generation that will have unprecedented size of a retired population that you'll have to carry. You'll be paying for the healthcare costs. You may be paying for some of their social security and their old age security, right? That's going to be a tremendous challenge for our country. We've got to build a productive economy so we can sustain an unprecedented number of people who are going to depend on health care and old age pensions. And the burden of that's going to fall on your soldiers, which is why we have to get this economy firing on all cylinders. We have to find the intellectual property that changes the game. We have to find the markets in Asia that are going to turn us into a powerhouse. And we've got to do it and stay Canadian. We're rightly proud of being Canadian. The social justice, the fairness, the tolerance, the equity, all of that comes at a price. You got to have a federal government that believes in those values, that's committed to those values, wants to keep this show on the road, wants to keep us together, wants to make the unity, the union of our people deeper and stronger and more enduring. And all of that requires an economy built on knowledge, innovation, daring, courage, all the qualities and values that are in this room. So that's kind of how I see the future, and that's just to get us going. So then, all better. Amuse bouche, comme on dit dans les restaurants. And now it's up to you. I'm questions. I don't know where the mics are. Where are the mics?
So I have a mic here. Pierre-Luc has a mic here. So we're going to take questions from the floor. So just raise your hand and I'll start going on.
Hi, my name is Lucas, and thank you for coming today. I want to vote for a candidate who is going to make Canada a role model for the rest of the world. And unlike Stephen Harper, I'm looking for someone who's going to take action and put an end to Canada's commercial seal slaughter, which is a bloody stain on Canada's reputation.
Let me be very direct with you. If you're looking for me to disavow the seal hunt, I can't do it, and I understand. I want to be clear. This is a subject in which I have great respect for the strength of your feeling on this issue, and we get a lot of very strong, passionate feeling that the seal hunt is wrong. But I have a colleague in the House of Commons of Canada from Labrador. His family has hunted the seal for, 10,000 years, in fact. His father's an Inuit hunter. And I've learned the role that a regulated seal hunt plays in the economies of the Labrador and Newfoundland outports and Gaspésie and other places. This is rooted in the traditions of our people, our fellow citizens. And if the seal was an endangered species, that would change the game. But my view, having listened very carefully to these communities and these peoples, is that this is a sustainable cull of an animal species. Now, many people will disagree, but I just thought I'd tell you straight up, that's how I That's how I see the issue. Thanks for asking the question.
Hi, my name is Saeed Kodakinia. I'm president of Youth Against Racism. Mr. Ignacio, as our future prime minister,
there are a few little steps we have to complete first.
I have full confidence. Don't you think it's high time that we experiment with pegging the Canadian dollar to the American dollar, a la the People's Republic of China?
I think, again, I'm starting two questions in a row, which I'm disagreeing respectfully with the question. I don't know that this is so promising. My view is that pegging the Canadian dollar to the long-term secular decline of the American dollar is not a good idea. That's what I think. And I think that having an independent exchange rate is often tough for us. I mean, it's really tough if you're running an auto parts company in Ontario. I mean, they're getting clobbered by it. They built their whole business model on a 65-cent dollar, and now it's a 96. So I'm not saying a floating exchange rate isn't tough. It's murder. But I think it's also a guarantee of our independence and our sovereignty. It's a key lever that Canada enjoys to control its own economy. And I think we need to manage our own exchange rate. Now, you mentioned the Chinese currency. I mean, they're artificially depressing it and putting pressure on the whole global economy. That's another issue. And when we have the world at the G20, I think we ought to sit down with the Chinese and join other countries and say, now, wait a minute, you can't go on like this forever. This is creating imbalances in the global economy that are not good for China in the long run. But I'm a strong believer in maintaining an independent floating exchange rate for Canada.
Hi, my name's Jeff Riley.
And,
back here. Okay. And my question is just about the tar sands. And I see the Canadian economy is becoming more and more dependent on a dirty natural resource. And I'm just wondering, where do you think the change has to come from? Can it happen federally, or does it have to occur in Alberta for us to, you know, relook at this resource and maybe, you know, I don't know, even the economy of Alberta changing to depend on other sorts of economies instead of putting so much emphasis on this one resource?
Thank you for the question. I think what's needed here is federal leadership. We've had for 4 years a government that has done strictly nothing about this issue. I think that what we need is a federal government that says, here are the environmental rules of the road, period. That is, we need, as a national objective, a sustainable oil industry. I do not agree that we need to shut the oil sands down. I'll be frank with you. We've got these huge oil reserves. They're a potential source of strength for our country. They're an enormous source of revenue right now. But they need to be cleaned up. We need to incentivize the technology of carbon sequestration and capture. We need to have the strong incentives, in fact, strong regulation, that requires better water use. There's tremendous depletion of the Athabasca watershed. We need to make sure that the development in the region doesn't harm Aboriginal peoples or their health. All of these are objectives that can be defined by a federal government that's prepared to set up and say, here are the rules of the road. Ironically, when I talk to people in the oil sector, what they say to me is, give us the rules of the road and we'll live by them. I've heard oil industry leaders say we can live with cap and trade. That's, I think, where we need to go. Absolute caps on emission levels for the trading system so that we incentivize getting the carbon emissions under control. But we've got a government that's basically said for 4 years, let's wait for the Americans. We've handed the entire environmental policy of a sovereign country called Canada over to the United States. And I'm as pro-American a guy as you're ever going to find in Canadian politics, but even I think it's wrong. That is, we can't wait for Barack Obama. We can't wait for Waxman-Markey. We've got to start now. We've got three provinces that are prepared to move on cap-and-trade systems. We need federal leadership. I think if we do that, we can have a sustainable, enduring oil sector that is not producing dirty oil.
Mr. Ignatieff, thank you very much for coming to Concordia. My name is Lawrence David Bisset. On January 7th, Prime Minister Stephen Harper, in an interview with Peter Mansbridge, stated that it was, quote, standard constitutional practice for prorogation to be undertaken by the Prime Minister. Now, if the Liberal Party of Canada was to win the election and get the majority, would you be in support of either a legislative amendment to the Act of Parliament or, even more, opening up the Constitution to A, limit the powers of the Prime Minister when the exertion of said power runs contrary to democratic principles, or B, to limit the amount of numbers of prorogations that could be held within a set period of time, or at the very least, have to where prorogation could not be undertaken unless there was a majority vote in the House of Commons?
I like that phrase when you say said power. I thought I heard a lawyer in the making there. Said power. Party of the first part. Prorogation, shutting down Parliament. This has turned out to be a very interesting example of exactly what I was talking about earlier. Mr. Harper gambled on the cynicism of the Canadian people. He thought no one would care if he shut down Parliament. And he turned out to have gambled wrong. It's been rather, in a way, kind of inspiring 10 days in Canadian politics. People don't like the idea that the Prime Minister should shut down Parliament, not once, but twice, within a year. And what they don't like about it is, A, that it was done sneaky on New Year's Eve when he thought no one was watching. Secondly, they don't like it because they think he's got some questions to answer about the Afghan detainees, and he's using prorogation to avoid answering those questions. Third, they don't like it because he's, you know, just come back with Copenhagen with empty hands and ought to face scrutiny about his environmental policy. But they also don't like it for much more basic reasons, which is, in our idea of democracy, it is Parliament that's sovereign, not the Prime Minister. That's the key issue. And people think Parliament, for all its, you know, God knows Parliament isn't perfect. I'm a parliamentarian and I know how imperfect it is, but it's what we got. Now, to your question, I think it's very clear that prorogation is a power that is in the hands of a prime minister. But any prime minister with respect for democracy has to use it in the most sparing possible way. You're then taking it, that is to say, I think we have learned, any politician looking at this knows, I can't prorogue Parliament to avoid legitimate scrutiny and criticism, right? That's what we take away from that. Do we need to abridge the power of prorogation with, you know, legislation or making prorogation depend on a vote in Parliament? I think we need to think that through. There's some legitimate reasons to prorogue Parliament. That is, when you finish your legislative business, you know, you put your legislative program through Parliament, then you want to reset and come back with a speech from the throne. That's a legitimate reason to prorogue. But none of the reasons that they've advanced for prorogation are legitimate, and some of them are downright funny. Last night, Mr. Harper was on television or in an interview, and he said, you know, the problem with Parliament is that it creates instability. And he thought, what planet are we on here? I mean, you know, this is democracy, Mr. Prime Minister. You know, and the only person who's created sustained institutional instability in the last year was the Prime Minister when he lost the confidence of the House of Commons. So some of these arguments just don't bear serious examination. But to your point, we need to think seriously. What I'm not prepared to do for the moment is go where you're leading me, which is to legislative amendment of the power of prorogation. I think what you need instead is a Prime Minister who respects the institutions of Canada. A Prime Minister who says, this system works when a Prime Minister respects the fact that his power is constrained, limited by Parliament. It's a matter of convention, not a matter of law.
Thank you. gentleman is looking at his, over
right here,
because the mic is very far. And I can answer. Give his mic.
Thank you for coming here and answering your questions. What are your thoughts on the state of the Liberal Party and also gaining and picking up some momentum for a possible future upcoming election in Liberal? Thank you.
Wow. That's not what I expected. The state of the Liberal Party. How are we doing, folks? We doing all right? Let's go back to basic. Let me answer the question in a way you might not expect. What is the Liberal Party? It's a national institution. C'est une institution nationale fondée par un grand Québécois qui s'appelait Wilfrid Laurier. The reason I care about the party is that we don't have many national institutions that put Canadians from every walk of life, every race, religion, every national origin in one room and say, how do we make the country better? And that's why I care about it as an institution. It's much more than an electoral machine, in other words. It's a national institution. What I want to persuade some of you to join it. But not as an electoral machine, but as the way into the national conversation about how we shape the country together and move forward. And so we've got a big recruitment job. In my first year as the leader of the party, we've tripled the membership of the party. That's a good thing. But we need to triple it again and triple it again. So we've got work to do there. We need to raise more money. I actually like a political system in which there are limits on what I can get from big business, big unions, big anybody. I like a party rooted in mass fundraising, but it means I'm going to need $5 from you sometime soon, right? You know what I mean? I mean, and that's how you build it. And in some places we have very strong organization, and in other places we're weaker than we should be. I'll be frank with you. There's some, il y a des comtés au Québec où nous sommes beaucoup plus faibles que j'aimerais être. Parce que je veux que, qu'on soit une institution nationale, ça veut dire pas une institution basée à Montréal, mais une institution avec des racines à, je ne sais pas, à Trois-Rivières, Chicoutimi, le Gaspésie, partout. So that's my vision of the organization, that it's truly national, urban, rural, north, south, east, west. Don't get me started on the west. We've got an enormous challenge out west. We've got people who just are allergic to voting liberal because of things that happened 30 years ago. And we want to say to them, particularly in Alberta, I've been to Alberta 7 or 8 times, it's not the most promising place to be a liberal, but I'm determined to get some seats back in Alberta because I want us to be a national institution. And, you know, we have these fantasies about each other as a people. We have this idea, you know, they all wear cowboy hats in Alberta. No, you go to Edmonton, you go to Calgary, it's as multicultural, as diverse as Montreal. Right? The West is changing, and we need to be there to make an appeal to Westerners that is as convincing as it is in downtown Montreal and downtown Toronto. And the final challenge is, as I think you're hearing, I don't want us to be a party of the downtown. Je suis plus à l'aise downtown à Montréal. Mais nous sommes un pays énorme, vast. I want to be a party of rural Canada as well as urban Canada, of northern Canada as well as southern Canada, of the small towns as well as the big cities. That's the vision of the national institution. And you ask me how we're doing, we've got some work to do. But that's the goal, that's the vision that I have.
Thanks for coming, Mr. Natia. My name is Sam LeBrier. I wanted to ask you today about your green energy plans. First, let me preface my question by saying that up until about 6-8 months ago, I was a huge supporter of the idea of green energy. However, now not so much. And the reason why, the question I want to ask you is, how do you propose that we in Canada do things like manufacture cars, manufacture airplanes, or even simple things like forging steel with green energy technologies like solar, wind, geothermal?
You're saying it's unrealistic.
It's impossible. You can't generate the amount of power necessary.
Yeah. I think that skepticism is actually a good way to start. Let's not promise people false green rainbows. Let's understand where we are. I mean, it's consistent with what I said earlier about the oil sands. I mean, this is very tough stuff. We have to have a portfolio vision of our energy future in which we increase the amount of renewable energy, solar, wind. In Atlantic Canada, it'll be tidal. We've got huge potential in tidal, right? Geothermal. All that stuff's important. And then I'm going to say something you're not going to like, which is I think nuclear has a place here. I don't see how we can meet the climate change crisis unless we have some part, not a huge part, but a part for nuclear.
I'm actually very pro-fusion, nuclear fusion.
You're pro-fusion. Well, that's good to know. But your point here is let's be realistic about what green energy can actually deliver. The other key element here, which would be consistent with what you're saying, is energy efficiency. When I talk to industrial workers in my riding, and I've got a lot of industrial workers in my riding who work in auto parts and that kind of stuff, and you ask them, how are you going to keep your jobs? They know one thing. When they melt aluminum to do casting, they've got to get their energy costs down. They got to shoot less heat up the stack and burn less electricity, right? They got to get it to those temperatures, but we got to find a way to do that in a more efficient way. If we don't, we're out of the auto parts business. It's that simple. So people talk about green energy and environmental stuff as if it's a kind of add-on. No, it's the key to our economic survival. And those industrial workers understand that. And we have to incentivize that. We have to make it much easier to transition to more intensive, more efficient energy use than we've done so far. And we can't go on promising, this gets back to your starting premise, we can't promise Canadians green solutions that aren't realistic about the industrial realities and the competitive realities we face.
Earlier at the UDAEV, you mentioned that you wanted to see Canada maintain some sort of presence in Afghanistan following after we pull out the troops in 2011. I know that there's some talk of the provincial reconstruction team staying post 2011 because, well, it's part of the international presence in Afghanistan. But those teams are pretty good. December 30th, the same day that we found out Harper requested. Four soldiers serving the PRTs were killed, and students and journalists traveling with them. So what kind of presence do you see Canada having in Afghanistan after 2011, where we can maintain some sort of continuity, but where we're not in danger?
Thank you for the question, and you are the very definition of a glutton for punishment. To go to two of these things in a day, boy, I have to do that, but you know, good for you, anyway. Afghanistan is the question. Let me give you the context here. I said at HEC that in 2011 our combat mission should come to a complete end. No ifs, ands, and buts. We have sacrificed. We've paid the full price. We've been good allies. We've done very difficult things in difficult circumstances. We have reason to be proud of that, but our mission should come to an end. And I think that's in fact consistent with the Obama policy, which is to begin to draw down military, full force surge military capacity in Afghanistan in 2011. But then the question, which we raised at HSA, is, okay, so what do you do after that? The issue that you're raising is we have a provincial reconstruction team in Kandahar, which is trying to do reconstruction work, and every time they go out of the wire, they get shot at, and four people die, and they get blown up. Which then raises the biggest question, which is, what can we do safely in Afghanistan after 2011 if we pull the troops out? And there's another question, is who do we do it with? I raised this question this morning. Let's be honest here. The Karzai government has problems. Its corruption is notorious. We have the right to say this, by the way. Some people were a little shocked by how sharp I was about President Karzai. But we have the right to say this. We went to his defense. We have sustained that government for nearly a decade, right? We have the right to say, you got to pull up your socks, right? But then the difficult question for Canada is, what can we do that's safe? My vision is that, and who do we do it with? Can we do it with a government about which we have doubts? Not so sure. Can we work with NGOs? Can we work with civil society? There are a lot of fantastic Afghan partners who want to educate young women, who want to give villages the capacity to generate new forms of employment. There's some infrastructure we can build. But who do we build it with and who do we build it for if we can't trust the government? That's a question I think Canadians now have to ask honestly. We've got the time to ask it. One of the reasons we want to have Parliament sitting is to ask this kind of question, to debate this kind of issue fully, as opposed to just drift into some kind of improvised mission after 2011 that doesn't make any sense. Because no responsible prime minister is going to send an aid worker to Afghanistan if we think their lives are at risk, if we can't provide security, right? And nobody, no Canadian is going to support continued investment in a country if the government is so corrupt that none of its own people believe in it. Don't mishear what I'm saying. I'm a passionate believer in sustained engagement in this incredible country. I've been there 3 times. They have some wonderful people. But we've got to ask tough questions about what we can do and what we can achieve, and what we can achieve in safety. And we need a debate about that and a full discussion.
Mr. Ganagif, you're internationally regarded as an expert in nationalism and unity. Do you believe that the time is coming when we'll be able to turn the corner on the issue of national unity by bringing Quebec into the Constitution?
Don't go there. As somebody just said, don't go there. And it's an excellent question. Thank you for the question. It's a serious question. I think where I come out, this is a long discussion, is that I think Canadians do not want to open constitutional discussion at this time. It's more than it feels like a trip to the dentist. It feels like a very, very painful trip into a political cul-de-sac. I don't think the conditions are right for what you and I think most Canadians would like, to have Quebec formally ratify the Canadian Constitution. I don't think the conditions are there. I think the conditions can be there, but they're not there now. Let me just add something else that you might not expect. I don't think our national unity issues in Canada are actually about Quebec and Canada. I think they're very different now. I think the divisions between urban and rural Canada, between northern and southern Canada, between an upper middle class that has benefited tremendously from economic growth and advance in the last 25 years, and a middle class that's basically whose income has basically stagnated for 30 years. In other words, class divisions are now as important. The question of maintaining multicultural peace and tolerance, these are the unity issues that strike me as being more salient now than the unity issues of the 80s and 90s. And one of the weaknesses we might fall into as a country is every time the word unity is said in Canada, we talk about one issue and neglect all the others that seem to me just as important. So I hope that's an answer to the question, though not necessarily the answer you expect. Thank you.
Mr. Ignatius, I'm Hector. On the subject of Afghanistan, it's already been brought up. I believe you said that Canada not participating in Iraq was contrary to its human rights stance. And also, I believe you've supported torture in the past. And so we're in Afghanistan now, and the reason I bring this up is because here is Oshawa, who's lost jobs. People are losing jobs everywhere. There's no money. The Toronto Star has said that women suffer most from the fact that they don't get EI benefits. You just spoke about Afghan women.
Let's get to the point.
Yeah. No, we're getting to the point. Why don't you take a stance the same way that the Bloc Québécois and NDP has, pulling troops out now and using the money that has been wasted in a mission that is going nowhere to get to the EI benefits for people who are not getting their EI benefits and welfare?
Hector, good question, though some of the premises were a little weird. I don't know where you got this stuff about my background, but I'm not going to go there. Just on the issue of why we don't pull the troops out now. Because Canada's a serious country. We make promises to NATO. We make promises to the Afghan government. We keep them. Third reason why we don't pull out now is we passed a parliamentary resolution which commits us to 2011. Serious countries, serious governments make promises and then keep them to the letter. And our promise extends to 2011 and no further, right? That's why. Can we use the resources once we come home to do some of the things that you want us to do? To improve employment insurance, particularly for women and single women who run families alone and are under pressure. Absolutely. But it's very important for countries to make promises and keep them and carry them out.
But it's a colonialist mission.
Well, that's I don't know. Hector, I don't want to get into a long debate, but the one thing that Afghanistan is not is a colonial mission. Remember the key point. The key point about this mission is that we are in Afghanistan with the full authorization of the United Nations and above all the full permission, the explicit permission of the Afghan people, government, and parliament. That's why it's not colonial.
I'd like to take this opportunity to express my disappointment at the collapse of the proposed coalition government.
Yeah.
My question is my question is whether or not we could have done more to reassure Canadians that this was constitutionally legitimate, and whether why you think that this was such a tough sell.
Coalition, boy, it's getting hotter and hotter and hotter. No, it's a great question, and Hector's question is a good question, too. Look, I just felt that a coalition was constitutionally legitimate, to pick up your point. It's perfectly legitimate for parties to get together and form a majority in Parliament and propose. I mean, there's nothing constitutionally illegitimate about it. What I felt was missing was political legitimacy, raw political legitimacy. I'll be very frank with you. We had just come out of the October election with the worst result in recent memory. I didn't think we had the political legitimacy. It's a different point. And these are the political judgments I get paid to make. They're not much fun. There have been moments when I thought, boy, it'd be nice to have Mr. Harper out of there. But you got to do it right. And it relates also to something else which is difficult to say. And I know, I assume many of you are supporters of the NDP or supporters of other parties, and I respect those support. But I'm a liberal. I'm a convinced liberal. I want to govern from the center. I'm interested in forming a liberal government. Right? If I have to choose between recreating a political system in which we have a party of the right and a party of the left, we leave the center unoccupied. And I think the Liberal Party belongs in the center. We give moderate, pragmatic government.
It doesn't exclude working with the NDP. It's never excluded working with the NDP. We wouldn't have Medicare had, you know, Tommy Douglas and Mike Pearson not worked together. You can work together with the NDP, you know, and I hope we'll work together again. But there's another issue we can't walk by. I'm a Federalist. I believe in Canada. I can't do a deal with Gilles Doucet, with the greatest respect. I felt Mr. Harper began to diabolize les séparatistes, les mauvais séparatistes. Je pense pas ça, ils sont mes frères et sœurs. I believe in Canada. That's what it really was.
We're going to take only 4 or 5 more questions.
Hi, Mr. Nani. I brought my 2 daughters here today with me. And one of the reasons why I brought them is because I really don't ever want them to become apathetic about politics. And one of the reasons why I care about politics is because I grew up in a family that was very interested in politics. And obviously everyone who's here today is interested in politics. But what I want to know is that there's so many people who aren't. You talked about in the beginning about all the people, 20% of 18-year-olds voted. How do we get the people who don't care to care?
Wow. I don't want to overdo this, but I because I don't think there are miracle solutions to your question. That slide in voter participation that I talked about, from 80% of people voting in 1960 to under 55% voting in 28, has been going on for 50 years, and not just in Canada, but in most democratic societies. One of the moments that ought to have been a wake-up call for Canada is that in 2008, we went through a milestone that I think was an embarrassment to our country. For the first time, voter participation rates were higher in the United States than they were in Canada. Right? Why? Because Barack Obama went door to door and got blacks who'd never voted to vote. And he went door to door and got young people to vote, and they never voted before. That's the answer. That's why those numbers went up. Because he mobilized from the ground up. So, how does that apply to Canada? Goes back to the question I asked earlier about having a Liberal Party that has the membership across the country to mobilize to get people out to vote. That's what political parties do. People forget what we do. We sit there and we phone you and phone you and phone you. We drop stuff in your mailbox. We meet you at the store and we say, come on out. Every political party does that. That's the basic machine to drive up voter participation. If those political parties are weak, the vote totals begin to go down. The other thing, finally, is you've got to have a platform, you've got to have a vision that people care about. You've got to offer something that matters to people. Right? That's my job, that's the job of my parliamentary colleagues, to get you something to make you feel fired up and want to participate and want to vote. I think one of the things that's driving voter participation down is a sense of alienation at the needless hyper-partisanship of the political game in Ottawa. You know, I'm a proud partisan. Right? As I said earlier, I believe, I'm a liberal. I believe in being a liberal. But I don't think we have a monopoly on truth or virtue. Right? I want to be partisan, but I don't want to be hyper-partisan. I don't think he has 2 horns and a tail. I just don't think he's a very good prime minister. And all... So, if you want to sustain people's faith in politics, we have to walk the line, as Johnny Cash would say, between being committed partisans, but not being so hyper-partisan, we turn everybody off. So those are some thoughts I have about that. And finally, we got to have more meetings like this. It's that simple. We've got to get people to come out.
Thank you very much for coming, Mr. Johnson. You mentioned earlier that a serious government, a serious leader would
would take its commitments seriously. How do you respond to the Liberal government's failure to honor its Kyoto Protocol promises? And more recently, I would say its failure to support Bill C-311, which would have brought us towards a closer to our Kyoto commitment.
Let me take this Bill C-311. This was a bill sponsored, a private member's bill sponsored by the NDP, which would it had some targets, it had some mechanisms to get us consistent with Kyoto. And our party supported the objectives of the bill, the basic principles, but we had very substantial difficulties with the details. And in Parliament, I can't just vote for good objectives. I have to vote for a bill I can vote for. The details have to work. And just give you one example of why C-311 was problematic. It gave the federal government powers in the environment which would have given us a nightmare with the provinces. Just as a detail. I don't want to get into kind of insider baseball, but that was a substantial problem for us. The drafting of the bill was faulty. So we shared the objectives, but we couldn't go with the NDP because we felt that that just caused us constitutional problems we couldn't support.
My name is Andrea Beebe. I'm a professor of political science. I teach a course on the Middle East, and as you very well know, we've had 6 decades of a very serious problem, and that's the Israel-Palestine question. I usually ask my students at the end of the year, and this way they find out what one of the questions was to be. I usually ask them, how do they envisage a solution to the Israel-Palestine question? As future Prime Minister, how would you do that?
I'm wondering whether or not I'd enjoy being in your classes or not, because they sound like tough questions. Just a preface, I am going to answer the question, but just a preface. One of the things that's remarkable about Canadian life is that of all the issues that passionately divide Canadians, the Middle East is more salient than many things that happen inside our own country. And if you ask me what I care about here, I actually care about this country most. I care about the way we debate this, in other words, that we maintain civility. You just look at this room. Look at the diversity in this room. You are in a classroom, right? You know all about this. But I have the same responsibility as a political leader. That is to listen to both sides with respect and to propose moderate, sensible, non-inflammatory approaches to the problem. And I've not always been perfect in that regard. You've got to choose what you say carefully in this area, because this touches the passions and identities of people in this room. And so my duty is to care about keeping us civil and keeping us together. That's actually my primary stake in this. My party and you know, myself have always believed that there are two rights in conflict in the Middle East. And the only way towards peace is if both of these rights are met. That is, that the people of Israel have a right to be there. They have a right to be there in perpetuity. They have a right to be recognized as a legitimate state. Canada has deep ties to Israel that are familial, ancestral, and also connection between one democracy and another. I've lived in Israel, I've worked in Israel, I've also been in Gaza, I've also been in Ramallah, I've also been in Jenin, I've also been in Jericho. I know these places. These places are in my bones. But equally, I don't think any Canadian wants to deny the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people to have a state of their own, internationally recognized, living in peace side by side with the state of Israel. And a state that is viable. not chopped up into little pieces, but viable enough to survive in the international environment, but to live in peace and to recognize the state of Israel on the other side. But everybody knows this. That's where it has to end. It mustn't end in Armageddon. It must end in peace and mutual recognition. And Canada can play a role, and Canada has played a role. Through Mr. Pearson and the peacekeepers in 56, right until the present day. We have Canadian experts helping the Palestinian Authority improve their security. That's a legitimate thing for us to do. We've had a role since Madrid with the refugee issue. We can continue to do that. We're a country that is respected there, so we can play a role if we're asked. Let's not get over ambitious here. It's a bitter, difficult conflict, but if we can play a role, we should be there. But I come back to where I started. What matters to me, particularly on Canadian campuses, is that we find a way to talk about this that doesn't divide us. Because we're neighbors, we're friends, we're stuck with each other. We've got to live together with each other on this issue. And so it's actually the unity of Canada on this issue that matters to me more than anything else. And that's where I put my emphasis as a public figure.
Hello, my name is Jonathan. I'm a theater student here at Concordia. And my question is about the Canada Council for the Arts and your views on that, and also your views. You've talked about identity, and you've talked about unity, and you've talked about it being more than a question of two solitudes. And I was wondering about your opinions on the Canada Council for the Arts, on how it functions as an institution, and what it does for diversity in Canada, and is it successful or not, and what your views are on it.
Thank you. Pablo Rodriguez, le député d'Honoré Mercier, et moi, nous avons beaucoup parlé du Conseil des Arts. I'm a very passionate believer in the work of the Canada Council because it's peer review by artists. That's the key to it. And that's what we need to preserve. Artists evaluating other artists as opposed to bureaucrats evaluating artists. That's a good model. It's not perfect because artists can be as corrupt as any other group. I've been an artist, I've been a writer, so I'm not talking anybody down. But that balance of peer review is, I think, key. I think increasing and sustaining investment in the Canada Council is something that we have committed to, am I right? And much more generally, one of the little lines that the Conservatives always use, they slip in this word elitist all the time. Elitism. Very concerned about elitism. They've called this cross-campus, cross-country campus tour I'm doing elitist, because I'm actually talking to university students, and go figure, right? And sometimes they have made the fatal mistake of calling investment in the arts elitist. It cost them a bunch of seats in Quebec. It deprived them of the majority. They discovered the absolutely fatal political consequences of underestimating the strength and attachment that the people of Quebec have towards their cultural industries. This is a key political fact. And I think, you know, for electoral reasons, but also for reasons of principle, investment in the arts is an investment in a key industry, particularly in the Montreal region. But it's much more than that. That sounds too economistic to talk that way. It's also about our identity. When you ask, who is it that defines and speaks for us? You think very quickly of Robert Lepage. You think of Cirque du Soleil. You think about Les Animateurs. You think about our writers. They are the mirror that tell us who we are. And a smart government invests in mirrors, even when those mirrors show you stuff you don't necessarily want to look at. So I'm a pretty passionate believer in this. I think it's made our country stronger. I think it's made it better. And it's part of the necessary investment we need to make in our future. Thank you for the question.
Hi, you mentioned earlier the fundamental restructuring that's occurring in the Canadian labor market. The way I see it, we're moving towards a knowledge-based economy and a service-based economy. So I'm just wondering what you see the role of the government as being in terms of easing the transition for the Canadian people in terms of ensuring accessibility to education and benefits and social welfare benefits so that people don't get trapped in a cycle of precarious work and unemployment that could essentially qualify them as the working poor.
You've asked a huge question, and let me try and just take one piece of it. You better get your phone off there. It's trying to tell you something. One of the situations I think we're backing into is a paradox, which is stubbornly high unemployment as a result of this global restructuring. Stubbornly high unemployment in places like the forestry sector and manufacturing, in many areas, that's going to endure for a couple of years. High unemployment, and get this, folks, here's the most disturbing economic statistic in Canada today is that youth unemployment is running twice the national average. Unemployment rates for youth are 16%, 17%, 18%. The national average is 8.5, okay? And that we have to do something about, and our party will be coming forward with proposals on meeting the youth unemployment challenge shortly. But the paradox that I want us to focus on longer term is we're going to have enduring high unemployment, in my judgment, in 2010, 2011, even possibly in 2012, coupled with skill shortages, manpower shortages, combined with high unemployment. One of the reasons we will have manpower shortages is the baby boom generation is retiring, right? So people are leaving the labor market. We're not bringing in enough immigrants. And then here's the kicker. The people we've got haven't got the skills for the jobs, and this is where you get to the role of government. 40% of Aboriginal Canadians between the ages of 20 and 24 have not completed high school. 1 million Canadians in Canada have not completed high school. 1.6 million Canadians have level 3 literacy, which means they do not have the literacy skills to hold down a job. That's how you begin to understand the paradox that we could have high unemployment and at the same time skill shortages. We have people who are not able to participate in our labor market. And that's where I think we need to go. We need to have a national strategy that attacks literacy. You can't get into this labor market if you can't read and write. We've got 1.6 million people who are not ready to play. We've got Aboriginal Canadians not completing high school. We've got Aboriginal Canadians who can't get into this room to join this discussion because we haven't got the funding for Aboriginal post-secondary education, and my party's committed to lift the cap, the 2% cap, on investment in Aboriginal post-secondary education. We've got to get Aboriginal Canada in this room.